Our first speaker this morning is Dr. Karen Bogenschneider. Karen is Associate Professor of Child and Family Studies at UW-Madison and Family Policy Specialist for UW Extension. She's Director of these Family Impact Seminars and has consulted with 10 other states and the Belgium government on implementing similar seminars. Her published research focuses primarily on adolescent development and how it is influenced by the social ecology, specifically the family, peer, work, and community settings of adolescents. She has also written or edited all of the briefing reports for this series of seminars. The community coalition effort she directed and started, called Wisconsin Youth Futures, received the Donald Burr Memorial Award for outstanding community service in this state. She serves on the editorial board of the Journal of Marriage and the Family. And on a personal note, many of you may have heard the story of Karen's frantic year before tenure, during which her secretary advised her that she needed to get really charged up. And the very next day, her car was struck and disabled by a lightning strike on her way to work. Many of you will be tempted to assume that the lightning came from the sky, and of course, Karen encourages this idea when she tells us that her very first words after the car coasted to a stop were, "Lord, you have my attention." But in fact, those of us who know Karen have always strongly suspected that the lightning originated from inside the car itself, from the vicinity of the driver's seat. Karen.
You know, there's just one thing, though, that you forgot to mention that really qualifies me to speak on today's topic, resilience. And I don't mean to boast, but I think I might have one qualification that no one else on the panel has, and I bet nobody in this room has. Let me show you. How many of you have opened the local newspaper and found your photograph? Are we ready to go here? Let me show you this. In the obituary section. That's my news column right there in the obituary section. As Mark Twain once said, I think the reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated. So I have this unique kind of resiliency, Dave, which didn't appear on my resume. Almost a half of America's youth, aged 10 to 17, abuse alcohol and other substances, commit crimes, fail in school, or engage in early unprotected intercourse. Yet some of these youth, who face many risks, do remarkably well, and they're quite resilient. And by resilient, I mean kids who do well despite seemingly insurmountable odds. So today I'm going to address the question, do we know how to build resiliency in youth and reduce risk in youth as well? Now, in the prevention field in the last 20 to 30 years, our scientific knowledge of how to prevent youth problems has really reached an all-time high. We've learned what types of programs don't work. For example, we know that providing information only doesn't work. Scare tactics don't work. Building self-esteem doesn't work. Teaching value clarification and decision-making skills to children too young to understand the concepts doesn't work. We know of another method that doesn't work. I'm going to let Dr. Andrews tell you about in a couple moments. Today, I'm going to describe two theoretical models that hold promise, I think, as the basis for effective policies and programs that build resiliency, the risk-focused model and the protective-focused model. First, one of the most effective prevention models to come out in the last 2 to 3 decades has been the risk-focused approach, which is used to prevent heart and lung disease. And this approach focuses on the risk factors for heart disease. And if I ask you, I bet you could all tell me what these risk factors are. You know, smoking, too little exercise, too much fat in the diet. And interestingly, informing people about these risk factors and actually encouraging lifestyle changes actually reduce the occurrence of heart disease. Now, would this model that emerged from the medical field also work in human development? One of the most important advances in the study of child development in the last couple decades is that human development is influenced not just by one factor, but by many. As with heart disease, taking steps to reduce or eliminate these factors that affect youth development might reduce youth problems as well. Now, a second model, the protective-focused model, has emerged from studies of children who face overwhelming odds in their life. You know, things like mental illness or physical disability, parents who are alcoholic, parents who are abusive or neglectful, poverty and war. And even with these glaring disadvantages, it's unusual for more than a third to a half of these kids to develop serious problems. This has prompted researchers to ask, what's right with these kids? You know, what protects these kids? And the findings of these studies suggest that it's important to focus on those characteristics of kids and those characteristics of their circumstances that promote resilience and competence in their lives. Now, some people have asked, which of these models is better, the risk model or the protective model, and which can best serve as a framework for guiding the efforts of policymakers in this area. Now, it's tempting to choose one model over the other, but I argue in a recent paper that both have validity and that neither alone fully captures the reality of the diverse youth population. So I propose instead a risk and protective focus model that combines both approaches. Now, this risk and protective model is really quite simple, as you can see here. Risk factors push toward dangerous development, and protective factors push toward healthy development. So to build resilient youth, you have to identify factors that push toward dangerous behaviors, risk factors, and reduce or eliminate their effects. Also, you can identify factors that push toward healthy development and promote or enhance those factors. Now, recently, some advocates of resiliency have advocated that we should focus only on assets or the protective model. And to me, focusing only on protective factors to help youth negotiate a risky environment seems short-sighted if we don't simultaneously try to reduce the number of risks that they have to resist. But on the other hand, if we focus only on the risk side, that seems kind of insufficient, because if we bolster these protective factors, it will enable youth to resist more risks. So I propose working on both, reducing risk factors and strengthening protective factors. Now let me define these terms for you. Risk factors are hazards. They can be in the individual or in the environment. They increase the likelihood that a problem will occur. Now, they don't guarantee a negative developmental outcome, okay? Just as if you have a high-fat diet, doesn't guarantee you'll get heart disease, right? But it increases the odds or the probability. So a single risk seldom places a child in jeopardy. But, you know, risk factors sort of accumulate. I kind of think of them like lead poisoning. And the more risk factors you have, the greater the danger. Now, protective factors, on the other hand, are safeguards. Again, they can be in the individual. They can be in the environment. And they enhance an individual's ability to resist problems and deal with life stresses. Now, sometimes I'm asked, are these risk and protective factors just opposite sides of the same coin? So we know, for example, that long work hours are a risk factor. Does that mean short work hours are a protective factor? No, that's not the case. These studies of risk and protective factors come from very different kinds of studies. Risk factors lead directly to a negative outcome in most youth. But protective factors, as I've just described, emerge from studies of youth who face very adverse conditions, things like parental alcoholism or neglect, poverty or war. So these protective factors exert their benefits only when a risk is present. So processes that protect youth from risk under conditions of very stressful life events may not necessarily protect youth who live under more stress-free environments. Now, I'm going to review some examples of risk and protective factors. I've reviewed almost 30 in the briefing report. Fortunately for you, I won't go through all of those today. But I've organized them beginning at the individual level here in the center, and then I'm going to move out to the family, peer, school, work, and community setting. I'm going to illustrate these with from data from one of my studies of 1,200 adolescents from a rural, suburban, and urban community in Dane County. And I'm going to start now at the individual level. These are all of the factors in the briefing report. And I'm going to start with an individual risk factor, antisocial behavior. Boys who are aggressive at ages 5, 6, and 7 are more apt to go on to abuse substances and to commit delinquent acts in adolescence. And to give you an idea of the predictive power of this variable, about 40 out of 100 kids who are aggressive in these early elementary years will go on to have problems later in adolescence. Now, we talk about 7 promising approaches for preventing juvenile crime in the Family Impact Seminar briefing report number 4. Another risk factor is early involvement. The earlier kids get involved in these risky behaviors, the less apt they are to have the maturity to avoid negative consequences. So, for example, when youth begin using substances before the age of 15, they are 6 to 10 times more likely to become addicted later in adulthood. Now let's move to the protective factors at the individual level. Well-developed social and interpersonal skills. Youth have personalities, these resilient youth have personalities where they're able to attract and keep supportive relationships around them. And teaching social skills has proven one of our most effective prevention strategies for preventing early sexual activity, for preventing smoking and marijuana use. And what really seems to work is older teens teaching their younger peers how to recognize and resist peer pressure to engage in risky behaviors. Another protective factor at the individual level is religious commitment. And religious beliefs serve as a protective factor for children from a wide variety of socioeconomic and ethnic backgrounds. And almost regardless of denomination, faith gives youth, I don't know, kind of a sense of connection, a belief that their lives have meaning, and also the confidence that things are going to work out, even though there might be some hard times right now. Now I'm going to move to the family level, as you can see here. This is the overview slide. I'm going to start with a family risk factor. Poor parental monitoring. This is one of the most powerful predictors of youth involvement in problem behaviors, virtually whichever problem behavior you look at. And by parental monitoring, I mean knowing where your kids are, what they're doing, and who they're with. And importantly, parent educators have been able to teach parents how to monitor more effectively. For example, through parent education classes, as Dr. Andrews is going to tell you about. And in my studies, through sending instructional newsletters to parents of adolescents. Now, in my studies, poor parental monitoring is related to delinquent behaviors. Here I was looking at the relationship of mothers monitoring to delinquent teen behaviors. And these were teen reports of being suspended from school, belonging to a gang, being involved in shoplifting, vandalism, fights, things like that. And as you can see, among teens who reported having low monitoring from their parents, they reported 4 times more delinquent acts than teens who reported high monitoring or close monitoring by their parents. And in this slide, and all of those that follow, the effects are above and beyond any influences of parent education, family structure, or child gender. I controlled for those variables. Distant, uninvolved, and inconsistent parenting. An authoritative parenting style is associated with fewer problem behaviors than parenting that's too strict, too lenient, or just plain uninvolved. So authoritative parents are warm and responsive on the one hand, but they still have firm, consistent rules and standards for the child's behavior on the other. And in the past 2 decades, home visiting has emerged as a very effective method for promoting competent parenting among high-risk families. Low parental involvement in school. When parents are involved in the schooling of their children, their kids get better grades, they're less apt to drop out of school, and they have much better homework habits. In my studies, I find higher grades even among children as old as high school age. And by parental involvement, I mean knowing what courses your child is enrolled in, you know, attending parent-teachers conferences, helping with homework when asked. And in my study also, parental involvement is a very powerful predictor of school success, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of parent education, and regardless of family structure. Again, importantly, parent educators are able to teach parents of both elementary and high school students how to become more involved in their children's schooling. A protective factor at the family level is a close relationship with one person. This is the factor that Dr. Erickson is going to be focusing on today. One good relationship can do much to offset the effects of other bad relationships. In high-risk families, this good relationship often comes from a grandparent or another relative. Also, could be a teacher or a neighbor who takes a special interest in a child. Now let's move to the peer level. Association with peers who engage in problem behaviors is one of the strongest predictors of kids getting involved in problem behaviors. And in my studies, as you can see here, those teens who reported a high peer orientation were twice as likely to report getting drunk in the past month as those who reported a low orientation to peers. Now, in other studies, they found that peer influence is 4 times more important than parent influence when you're looking at substance use. But in my studies, I've still found that parents are a very strong influence on their adolescent's development, and they can actually restrain their children's orientation to peers, primarily by being responsive. And by being responsive, I mean expressing love and praise to the child, being available when needed, and engaging in give-and-take discussions with the child. I'm going to move to the school level. According to Richard Price, if you wanted to invent a social institution to mess up kids, you couldn't invent anything better than a middle school or a junior high. We make these kids make changes just when they're going through a lot of physical and social and psychological changes. So when kids move into a middle school or junior high, their academic achievement goes down, extracurricular participation goes down, Alcohol and drug abuse is apt to increase, and feelings of being anonymous go up as well. Now, according to James Garbarino from Cornell, if he could do only one thing for teenagers in America, he would ensure that no child attends a school larger than 500. Large high schools produce more alienation, more antisocial behavior, and higher dropout rates. In small high schools, extracurricular participation is twice that in larger schools. And curiously, the borderline students feel a sense of involvement and commitment to that school that's very similar to more successful students. A positive school experience can be a protective factor. This doesn't have to be academic success. It can also be social success, a positive relationship with a teacher, the opportunity to take leadership, or it can be success in sports or art or music. And as you can see on this slide, in my studies, students who reported a low commitment to school reported twice as many delinquent acts as students who reported a high commitment to school. The community level. Risk factor is complacent or permissive community laws and norms. Policies that are unwritten, unclear, unenforced increase youth involvement in problem behavior. When you have a clear message, like a higher taxation on liquor, that decreases alcohol use among teens, among both light and heavy users. And belonging to a supportive community. This is a factor that Dr. Pierre is going to be focusing on. Resilient youth rely on a greater number of people, such as neighbors or teachers or clergy and youth workers, than youth who don't cope as well. We also find that mothers are warmer and more stable when there's more adults around to help. And actually, one of the best predictors of child abuse is social isolation of the family. Now, I've also looked at the number of risks and how this affects teen substance use. So I took six different risks to see how they predict teen substance use. And as you can see, if you only have one or two risks, it's not too likely that teens will use substances. But as the number of risks increases, 3, 4, 5, 6, you can see that the likelihood that teens will use substances also increases. I found exactly the same pattern for delinquency. The take-home message here is that we need comprehensive, multidimensional approaches that address multiple risk factors. Let me give you an example here. If we were going to address alcohol use and abuse among teens, we need to provide parent education, increase student engagement in school, and teach refusal skills and other efforts as well. I want to point out a limitation of this risk protective approach. A limitation is that not all risk and protective factors have the same power or influence on youth development. So of course we're going to be more successful if we focus on those factors that are more powerful. Now, what implications does this have for policymakers? First of all, it's important to focus on proven risk and protective processes. You know, selling self-esteem to children has become big business, despite little evidence that improving self-esteem affects youth involvement in problem behaviors. Develop comprehensive approaches. Most problem behaviors have not one cause, but really many. And all too often, I think we look for single factors. We look for kind of simple solutions to complex problems, magic bullets, I call them. And the piecemeal band-aid approaches that result have not worked and cannot be expected to work. It's important to involve parents for long-term success. In a longitudinal study that followed children from birth to age 32, they found that parenting was the best predictor of long-term outcomes. It was even more important than biological or physical complications that they experienced during pregnancy and delivery and the early years of life. So emerging evidence suggests that parent education and family support improve parenting competence, and this in turn has long-term benefits for children. Now, invest in programs with evidence of effectiveness. Only good programs produce good results. We know some of the prevention strategies that work. We know it's important to teach parents to be more authoritative and to be more involved in the schooling of their children. We know it's important to teach youth peer refusal skills. We also know some methods that work. We know home visiting works. We know parent education classes work, some of them. We know instructional parent newsletters work. Broad-based community programs work. Intervene early and continuously. There are no magic periods of development. Programs provided early, however, hold the greatest promise. For example, Patterson's parent education program was very effective in reducing child aggressiveness. The success rate was a resounding 63% when the children were aged 3.5 to 6 years old. But it reduced to 27% when the children were aged 6.5 to 12 years old. So prevention efforts that begin before school entry, if you think about it, can focus primarily on the family environment. But once these kids have entered school, you've still got the family issue you need to focus on, but you also need to be focusing on academic failure, and oftentimes they're having problems with peers as well. So expecting short-term, one-shot programs to work is really unrealistic. Build on the naturally occurring support that already exists in the extended family, the neighborhood, and the community. You know, other people, other than parents, can play a supportive role, whether it be grandparents or big brothers and big sisters, youth workers in 4-H or Boys and Girls Clubs. And finally, remember the lesson of resiliency. The odds can be changed. From studies of parent education, we know that human beings possess the capacity for more competent parenting if given reliable information on how to do so. And for children who succeed against the odds, springs the message of hope. I'm going to end with a quote from Emmy Werner, who has done a lot of research in this area. She said, some things work, if not for every child, at least for many, if not all the time, at least some of the time, and if not everywhere, at least in some places.
We can take a few questions, and I will try to repeat them so everyone can hear them. Yeah. Beyond parent education, what do we know about teacher education to help with children who are hard to manage?
I'm not as familiar with that area. I do know that there are some very successful programs, for example, for preventing early aggressiveness. And some of these are carried out in the school. And some of them are kind of cognitive approaches, where you try to teach children to think a little bit differently about acts that might appear aggressive to them. Does anyone else on the panel know about efforts with teacher education? David, do you? David said many of the efforts have been more on the structure of the school. And I know there has been one successful prevention program published by Fellner in 12 ounces of prevention, which was 13 ounces of prevention, which was published by the American Psychological Association. And he actually, in these large schools, as I mentioned, their kids tend not to do quite as well. So they've tried to reorganize these large schools and make them seem more like small schools within this larger school. So, for example, they'll take a class of kids, like maybe 20 kids, and they'll move them through the day together so that they get to know these other kids really well. They will have special homeroom times with one person in the school so that they will get to know at least one person that they can go to if they have a problem. So I know there's been this effort to kind of create smaller schools within larger schools. David said the most successful efforts have included family and community involvement in that. We're actually going to be addressing that topic at the next Family Impact Seminar on Education on March 5th. We're bringing a speaker in from Washington, D.C., who just published a report on the importance of family and school involvement in the school.
Karen never loses an opportunity for an advertisement. Question here.
Yes. In some studies, work has also been a protective factor, especially if the work is needed in the family. You know, so if the young person is working and contributing to the family income, or if someone in the family is ill and they're helping out with younger siblings while parents are working, work actually can be a protective factor. And I noticed, too, in Larry Steinberg's study that if work benefits the family in some way, you know, so if children are working as part of the family business or contributing to the family farm, that also can also be a protective factor. But, of course, the studies show that not many adolescents do contribute their income to the family. You know, according to Larry Steinberg, he says, parents become almost impotent when it comes to their children's earnings. They don't say that they need to save half of them. They don't say that they need to contribute to the family income. So, consequently, children have a lot of money to spend. I know some people have called this premature affluence, where you have, you know, $200 a month just to spend on yourself for whatever you want. And they're concerned about what the long-term effects of that might be. Because as you know, when we have families, you don't always have just that much money to spend on yourself. So
there's been some concern about this premature affluence. So when there is contributions to the family, it's helpful, but the study suggests it doesn't happen very often. And of course, many kids are supervised by adolescents who are just a couple years older than they are, and we find some of the more negative effects in those kinds of work situations.